Well, we'll be very, very short and get a lot of time to get material together again. Seems like that's getting to be a common thing. Let's start almost back from the beginning. We're looking at myths as almost as direct expressions from the spiritual worlds. That is, we're talking directly about God, we're talking directly about forces that emanate from the divine beings and the way that they emanate in story form. And we're looking in that regard then as at myths as the last remnants of a universal language, a language that speaks to everyone and that has many sides and that speaks to all of the parts of our being. When we're looking at spirit, we understand that spirit is singular. Being is. And if there were another being, that being would also have or partake of being. So it's singular. And being maintains its unity throughout creation. And it maintains it in as many ways as possible. Even though things become very complex, and even though there may be very many polarities and spectral dispersions, a unity is maintained all the way through creation. In creation, vertically, unity is maintained in several ways. The first way that the vertical unity is maintained is in succedent causes. And those succedent causes are something like waves or ripples, that there are emanations, and those emanations, I don't know how to say it, solidify to various degrees of density within the one. That is to say, there, from the viewpoint of the spirit, there are succedent causes, and from our viewpoint, there are antecedent causes. Meaning to say that behind the world of matter, there is a world of energy that animates and moves matter. And behind that energy is motivation, which gives reason for moving, and thus and so on. And so there is a unity in that cause follows consequence in the creativity. It follows from the creator into the form of the creation. This also works through a bidirectional flow, so that the manifestation from spirit as it projects itself into matter, into the unknown, there is also another unity of cause and consequence, that there is experience that returns to spirit from matter or from the unknown. And so there is a unity of cause and consequence that way. There is also horizontally a unity also, such that there is on each plane, each cause, there is a unity where there is a complete, or I should say a whole, if not complete, reproduction of the one in each plane, which means to say that there is a parallelism between each and every plane in existence. And then there is the simple manifestation of these parallels, that there is a reproduction in each part of each cause or of each effect, and that is the principle of microcosm and macrocosm. That is, the whole or the one reproduces itself in each atom or in which within each being within the whole. Since we as humans constitute highly developed microcosms, where we are spiritually self-conscious of our whole being, we are aware in our whole being of us being miniatures or being microcosms of the one. And we are aware of all of the parallels on the different planes of existence within ourselves. We're looking at the growing awareness of this spiritual unity. We're trying to reach initiation where we wake up to this spiritual knowledge or intelligence within ourselves on each level of our existence. And the deeper we go within, the more universal we become in our understanding, the more we come to the simple but more deeply purposeful causes behind all of existence. That being the case, we're looking at initiation. We're looking at getting at the heart of the cosmos within the heart of our being. And we're looking at myths in that regard. And when we look at myths in that regard, we're trying to find, for example, the hero within ourselves. We're trying to find the way the spiritual forces work within our being and live out these stories so that we ourselves can fulfill the purposes of existence. And in the same way that the life or the energy of spirit expresses itself in the language of mythology as a story, we're trying to follow the stories of myths and the myths of heroes to that unfoldment. And that brings us right about to where we are. We want to look now at one of the special features of a quest myth. We talked about it the last time, and we said one of the things about a quest myth is that there is a group of heroes that all work together with some teamwork, and they come usually into some kind of formation that represents the formation within the cosmos or any one of a number of formations within the cosmos, and we're looking at that. And in light of what we've just said, we are looking inside of ourselves for a formation, and that formation represents the relationship of various principles of creation and of manifestation and of being within ourselves. We could do it for the entire round table. We don't have time to do that, really, and so we're going to pass that all by. We're not looking at all of the story of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. We're looking only at the quest for the Holy Grail that is called the Sangreal. And there are four knights that have anything to do at all with the Sangreal, and they are Sir Launcelot, Lancelot du Lac. There is Sir Bors, Sir Percival, Sir Galahad. Sir Lancelot is the son of Ban, who is a French king, and in his time he is the greatest knight of the Round Table. He is the best friend of Arthur, he is the cuckolder of Arthur, and he is sometimes a madman. Sir Borhart de Ganis, commonly called Sir Bors, is the son of King Borhart of France, and in some way related to Lancelot. It's not clear whether Ban of France and Borhart of France are brothers. Some versions say yes. Some just say that he's cousin. And the way the English used the term cousin, it could mean any kind of blood relation. Even uncle sometimes means almost any blood relation. Sir Bors is also the brother of Sir Lionel. Sir Percival is the son of King Pellinore, who was one of Arthur's good friends. And Sir Percival is sometimes called the flower of the knighthood of the Round Table. Sir Galahad is the son of Sir Lancelot, and Elaine, the daughter of King Pelles, and King Pelles is the direct descendant of Joseph of Arimathea, and probably the third generation, I think the grandson of Joseph of Arimathea, and he is the king that has the unhealing wound from the dolorous stroke that was delivered to him by Balin or Balan, I don't remember anymore. Sir Galahad is invincible. It turns out to be the greatest knight of all time, and he certainly is called the flower of the Round Table. All right, these are the people that we're going to focus on, and we're going to try and focus on them in such a way that we find them in ourselves, because that's what's most important, because this isn't going to just be a story about the Grail. It's interesting what happens with all of these things. As I get into the stories, try as I might, I get to certain stories and I treat them certain ways. And what is happening with the Grail, I don't know whether it's because of a period that I'm going through or because it's because of the material itself, or because I have to be very fast about this and try to get it done in hopefully two more talks after tonight. And in the process of going so swiftly, I find myself being extremely abstract and not very much in storytelling mode at all. And we're going to find that is the case again tonight, though next time we will certainly get into storytelling. Lancelot presents us with a very, very contradictory character. One that we can't really be certain of. On one hand, he is almost invincible. In his time, he defeats just about every other knight in the Round Table, and does so in a very clearly decisive manner. He loses a battle every now and then, but basically he wins just about everything. He is enormously strong, and he has a good deal of prowess. In terms of spirituality, strength has a number of things to say about it. Number one, since the muscles are the direct expression of the desire body, which is the reflected projection of the human spirit, the degree of desire that a person has is often indicated in the strength of the muscles. Some people even say, Rudolf Steiner, for example, says that if you're sensitive enough, you know what is called muscle tone. If you tense your muscles really hard and hold them that way, you know they'll quiver after a while. And if you listen, that Rudolf Steiner claims that the astral forces, being the reflection of the human spirit, he claims that you can hear the music of the spheres in the ringing of your muscles, which is a very interesting thing. So it seems reasonably safe to conclude that Lancelot is strong because of desire and because he is quite a serving knight. It's also reasonably safe to assume that his service in this life is a continuation of something done in previous lives, and there is a cumulative effect in the etheric body, which is the golden wedding garment, because the etheric body is all important for initiation, because no matter how spiritually awake someone is, someone cannot be initiated into the mysteries unless they have a very rich etheric body, because that is the vehicle into which the consciousness is transplanted when it leaves the physical body. Because if one tries to put the consciousness into the desire body or into the mind alone, those vehicles are so shadowy that the consciousness just doesn't hold together. And the way it works is every time that we do higher thinking and memory work, or every time we do acts of service from the goodness of our heart, or any time that we do very strong perceptive work, we're adding to the two higher ethers of our etheric vehicle. And they are, relatively speaking, they are immortal. That is to say, once the soul ethers are developed in the etheric body, they stay life after life after life, and one has a thicker light in which to walk and has a thicker consciousness, and the intuition gets clearer and clearer, and one can function much better in this world and in all of the inner worlds. But there's an interesting effect that what happens, there's sort of like a flow, a downhill flow in the ethers, because the strength or the accumulation of the two higher ethers that are associated with conscious functions, perception and memory and thought, the amount of growth that we have in one life passes in the next life down to the two lower ethers, to the life ether and the chemical ether. So that the result is, if we're very serving in one life, in the next life we'll have an enormous amount of vigor and an enormous amount of vitality. However, if we put a lot of work in that next life again into the two higher ethers, we can sometimes attenuate, relatively speaking. So it's safe then to say about someone like Lancelot that they probably are a very strong individual in terms of desire, and that they have a very strong hand-me-down etheric vehicle for vigor. And the third thing that makes for great strength is single-pointedness. When there is a quest for one thing and there is no division within the character that can draw off or interrupt the direction of the desire in vital bodies to the accomplishment of the physical. This is true in very prosaic things, that the muscles, when they are an expression, when they are used as an expression of desire, are so strong that they can actually break the physical body. There is a case of that in the NFL playoffs a few years ago. I think it was in a championship game. There was a young man from Wisconsin. I believe he was playing for Cincinnati, but I don't remember. And they had pictures of him where he used his leg muscles so strongly that he literally snapped the bones in his leg from the use of the muscles in his body. Lancelot does a number of things with his great strength, and among them he overcomes giants, and several times he overcomes giants, and this is a common theme among questing heroes or becoming heroes. And I think it has something to do, especially in the case of the Arthurian tales, it has something to do with overcoming old ways. Because every time that there is a hearkening back to giants or things like that, to titans, whatever, it relates to Atlantean times, and it's a throwback kind of consciousness. So in some way, it may be a reasonable interpretation to say that Lancelot represented something like a modern for his time. And the way it works with Lancelot, with his great strength and prowess in battle, he defeats everyone at the Round Table until a certain time, which means he actually even defeats Arthur, meaning to say that he could overcome Arthur at will. However, he exceeds him as a warrior, but he does not take over as a king. I will talk a little bit more about that later. Another thing about Lancelot is he's very physically beautiful. And there are several ways, I think, that great physical beauty occurs in the body. I think there are, I don't know how to say it, but it's almost, in order to appreciate it, one almost has to speak from only intuition. There are some people that are very beautiful and they are very pretty, but when you look at them, that statement that beauty is only skin deep is true. It is that it's as if they spent all of their time in between lives practicing building a pretty body. And these people are very often extremely neurotic and very troubled, and they value their prettiness to the point where in the weakness of their soul and their neurotic tendencies, that their beauty becomes almost a curse to them. Then there's another kind of beauty, and that's a kind of beauty where the physical vehicle becomes an expression of the inward moral character. It strikes me, you know, that some people are just so beautiful that they don't have to be pretty and they don't have to have all of the symmetries and all of those lovely features, but they're pretty anyway. And sometimes both are put together, and I tend to think that Lancelot was something like that. Now, it isn't told why Lancelot is not himself a king, but it is said in other ways that he really is a king. We're going to come to it in a probably next week, if not that, in the final week, that Lancelot is a relative of Jesus, And he's the son of a king, so he is in that way probably a king or has the royal blood in him. But there are other things that say it. Early in his knighthood, even before his encounters with the Grail and before he grows up, he is capable of healing people. And the ability to heal people used to be one of the only ways that you could tell a king. I think this goes all the way back to the time when the Mercurians and Venusians lived on the earth. That is to say, according to the mystery schools, those of the human life wave from Venus and from Mercury at one time came to earth to help us in our wayward ways, and they each did different things. All of the arts and sciences were pretty much established by the Mercurians, as were the mystery schools. But the divine kings were the result of the Venusians, and I think in some ways there were even hereditary changes. According to the ancient Greeks, one way you could tell a divine king that it had the hereditary makeup going all the way back to Atlantis was that they had a tuft of purple hair. But in more modern times, the way you could tell somebody who truly was a blue blood or a royal-blooded person was that they carried the ability to heal. And I think this had something to do with the nature of the way the vital body worked inside of the physical body, and there was some kind of genetic maintaining of that. There still is an illness that is called called King's illness, that only a king can, by a king by laying a hand on. I think it's called King's evil. I think I got it in my notes here that it's called King's evil, and that the only way that illness can be healed is by a is by being healed by a king. Lancelot is also a mentor and an example to a lot of the younger knights. And in the same way that the people all look to the king, anyone who is a mentor like that, in some ways, Lancelot represented more of the spirit and accomplishment of the round tables than of the round table and the knights than Arthur did, because Arthur was much more involved with statecraft and in judicious matters, and not so much in the activity of knighthood. Early, as he was establishing his kingdom, he was more involved with warfare, and when he had his battles with Rome and such like that, he was involved with the warfare. But as time went on, he became more involved with kingly matters. So on one side then, in looking at the positive attributes of Lancelot, we find him to be then sort of a representation of the round table. But not everything is perfect about Lancelot. He has some very, very glaring weaknesses, and they're glaring weaknesses even in knightly literature, because in knightly literature they make all of these high-blown statements about how wonderful this knight was and that knight was. It's almost like going to a racetrack and looking at the morning odds on different horses, and they're all built up to sound so great or something like that. And that's sort of what was behind the book Don Quixote, making fun of that high-blown language and all of those things about the knightly literature. He's moody and somewhat vengeful. He's certainly not the worst that way. I guess I would say that the Scotch knights, the kids of Lot, are more vengeful, and certainly Palamedes is more vengeful, but he was vengeful and he was moody. And I think when we're doing something self-consciously, that's the big difficulty in what we're trying to do with our lives. when we're self-consciously trying to grow, we often pay a lot of attention to ourselves. And we become egoistic in that, and we become self-centered in that, and it produces effects in us that make it the most difficult way to grow. And I think some of that results in, especially since everyone defers to Lancelot and everybody makes a big deal about him because he's the number one man, that he gets filled with self-importance. And when one is filled with self-importance, there is that indulgent kind of moodiness where one is not so rough and ready anymore, and one is not so humbly accepting of everything that comes down the line. One gets sort of almost in a way prissy. And so in that regard, if we're finding Lancelot inside of ourselves, that's a very common kind of thing. Another thing about Lancelot is sometimes he is very cruel and unfeeling. And this indicates somebody then, if we put this together with the other qualities, it shows somebody that is very desireful and it has a high amount of energy, but the self-conscious spirit does not permeate and does not imbue the entire desire nature, and for that reason, it becomes a little bit more autonomous than is good for it, and the desire nature can be tremendously, tremendously cruel. Then when we look further into the desire nature, we find that Lancelot is lustful, self-indulgently lustful. He cannot say no to his lustfulness. However, his lustfulness is singular. It isn't put upon many women, and it isn't described in a way that is forceful or anything like that. But the bad part of it is that it's the one woman that the lustfulness is focused on happens to be Arthur's wife, Guinevere. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a little while. Clearly, the character of Lancelot, because he is monogamous, that is focused on one woman, shows that the internal feminine is the total character. If we see for a male the things of the spirit being manifest in the feminine form, we then see that the dweller, the threshold, must also appear as a woman, but also the divine that we look for in the alchemical marriage, the union with the higher self or with God through the composite of all of our good deeds must also appear as feminine to us. However, if we're not really well developed in the feminine, we don't have a sense of things. There are many different aspects of the feminine, and we don't have a hierarchical sense, a pyramid of values about the feminine. And someone who is lowly developed would find themselves interested in many, many different kinds of women indiscriminately. And the fact that Lancelot focuses his attentions on one woman indicates that he has a unified conscious development of the soul. You see what we're trying to do in this? We're trying to describe something in the character of Launcelot and find it in ourselves and understand general principles of psychology in a spiritual sense, that is the logic of the soul and how it is constructed and what we can what we can conclude from about the character of Launcelot, who doesn't consummate the Grail but gets close to it. He's definitely a martial type of hero, otherwise he couldn't be number one. But he has periods of madness. Remember when we talked about Heracles having periods of madness and slaying his own children and such like that, and his brother-in-law's children or his cousin's children? Well, Launcelot has periods of madness also, where he chews grass and does things like that. It's one of those things, like the lot of the symbolism and a lot of the activities of madness come straight from the Bible. They take a strange form, but if you look at the madness of Nebuchadnezzar in the Bible and some of the things that he did, and then you look at Launcelot, you find that there are similarities between the two of them. So this is the case then of a martial type hero, someone who does things by force. Not only do they become cruel people, and not only do they become moody, but they're very subject to madness, because then when the spiritual qualities start working into the soul, and the soul is not yet old enough and mature enough, they turn into a kind of a frenzy, and that's what happens to somebody like Heracles. Much of his healing has to be done through penances, and many of them are quite humbling penances. Because the spirit isn't completely within him because of the enormous pride that he has. You know, before a person can go mad, that means that there has to be a separation of the spirit from the control of its own vehicles. And so this means that there's a high degree of egoism in him, and the spirit doesn't come all the way through. And so he has to go through these humbling kinds of penances. And then in these humbling penances, the spirit does come into him. He's eventually healed by the Holy Grail. He doesn't actually get to take the Grail itself, but he has something like a close encounter of the third variety with the Grail, and it's sufficient to heal him. He goes back to some of his old ways, in spite of all of that, and he ends up as a monk in the end. And we won't get a chance to talk about that because we won't get that far into the round table. Okay, if we're looking at hero myths and heroine myths as we have all year, and we see heroes as initiates and as the type of people we are trying to become, we should look at Launcelot in that regard. Launcelot is clearly not a hero. He does not accomplish the ultimate quest, and he has too many downfalls and is much too self-centered to actually be a hero. He gets to the door and he can just about knock, but he can't pass into the temple. He's something that is similar to a hero and something that is a precursory stage of development to the stage of developing as a hero. And that is a champion. And this is sort of a throwback to previous periods. A champion is something different. A champion is capable of subduing everybody else in his force. And in that activity, he becomes the representative of that force. But he doesn't actually do the miraculous things. He doesn't pass all of the trials, which are what the real heroes do. So if we think about it, Lancelot then, in terms of the inner activity, probably represents the champion we are to ourselves. That is ego with a small e, the second or lower self. And that entity, and it really is an entity, it is, it has the power over everything else, and it has a lot of good in it, and it has a lot of negative in it, and it's a reflection of true self, but it isn't self itself. You know what I'm trying to say? If another way, you know, well, I think we'll come to that in a little bit. So to a large extent, when we see ourselves as strivers and we get involved with all of that self-conscious mucky muck thing about ourselves, and we get wrapped up in the personal existence of our being and all of the egoism attendant to that, we're champions. We're striving to become heroes, but we're champions and we haven't quite made it. Now, this view of Lancelot helps us to then understand a lot about the battle that rages in ourselves, the battle between ego and self. It's the struggle that we're all going through, and it's a war that must be really fought. Now, it sheds a lot of light on a whole way of interpreting the round table in terms of our spiritual experience. We talked a little bit last time about the round table being a very highly sidereal myth, that the round table either could represent the zodiac, and the degrees of the zodiac are about almost half the degrees, I believe there are about 150 nights, at the round table, or seats at the round table. And it could represent the pole stars. But there's another way of looking at it, and that harkens back to a phrase in the New Testament of the Bible, I believe it's from Revelation, where it says, the beast has many eyes. So we can then see the round table as the circle of our waking consciousness. And within that circle of waking consciousness, if we look at all the disparate elements of ourselves, we see that we have many types of eyes. Eyes with the word, as in the word I am. Each of our thoughts, if given a life of its own, has an I-ness about it, and it clamors for attention, and it clamors for the center of our being. Each of our desires has an I of it. You know, there is Richard the lustful, and there is Richard the sentimental, and if I get into any kind of swoon, it's almost as though I'm another kind of person. Each of the actions, if we get into a style of action in the etheric body, that becomes like an entity unto itself. Each of the senses and the sensory experiences has an I nature all of its own. This is one of the downsides of the principle of macrocosm and microcosm, because everything lives. Even our thoughts, our desire bodies, all have, are alive and all have a quality of being. And that quality of being has, like in microcosm, like a selfhood of its own. And so, you know, that it, if we get into diffracted senses, or if we develop If we develop entities by manifesting a whole collection of desires within ourselves, we become a very divided character. And in fact, in this regard, the Lancelot, as the champion, sort of like the enforcer of the round table, represents that ego nature, which in itself is a higher desire world, lower thought world entity. It is a distorted image of the true self, which means that it is born of a king. And it controls all the other members of the round table, that is our circle of consciousness, and keeps each of them from seditiously uprising and taking over. And so this very clearly describes in our consciousness Lancelot's position in the round table. He's a divine plant. That is, he's described, I think, literally in Malory as the son of a foreign king. And he has to be strong, and he has to occupy that position so that all of the other desires become subservient to it. Because if they don't, we're in really tough shape. Because what do we call it when somebody has a very defeated ego nature, so that, to say nothing, multiple personalities are the immediate consequence of somebody that has low self-esteem and has never been allowed to develop it in a given life because the parents psychologically abused it from a very early age. So even though it becomes too strong for its own good, it's important that we have a strong sense of ego. This also describes the relationship between Lancelot and Arthur. If Arthur represents the central focus of consciousness, where both spirit and personality meet, individuality and personality meet, if Arthur tends more toward being self in the spiritual sense, that describes somewhat our relationship right now. This is the purpose for the ego in the first place. The lower self was inculcated into us by, according to the mystery teachings, it was inculcated into us because we were beginning to become individuals responsible for our own behavior. But this meant one thing. This meant that the gods were no longer responsible for us. They couldn't lead us around willy-nilly and control every facet of our lives. And for that reason, as we were falling into deeper materialism than was intended, we needed something for us to be able to take care of ourselves, even though it meant the accumulation of a gross amount of negative destiny, a burden of sin, and such like that. But we needed something to take care of us because the gods could no longer do it because they had to respect our divinity. And for this reason was why the desire body was stratified in the first place, and a thought form of an ego that was reflective of self was placed in it. And for that reason, that's why it exists. And it's clear then, in the same way that Lancelot can defeat Arthur at this point in evolution, relative to our existence in this world, very often the lower nature is stronger than the higher nature. We aspire to live in a noble, holy kind of way, and we have these high ideals, and we try to manifest them in the world, but despite ourselves, we still are often overthrown by that surly lower nature, the extremely strong desires in ourselves, and they're capable of throwing it over. It also shows it shows some of the relationship of the interaction between Lancelot and Arthur, because Arthur is indeed more like higher self, because no matter what Lancelot does with his wife, which is a coveting of the higher self, no matter what he does, Arthur doesn't say anything. And he certainly is not dumb that he doesn't know what's going on. And it's sort of like saying that self lets us do whatever we will, and it lets us play out all the line we want until we tire ourselves out with it, and it all gets turned into spirit anyway. It describes a lot of different things. So this also describes then some of the flaws of Lancelot, because the personal ego, the lower self, is subject to all the limitations of the phenomenal worlds. It isn't perfect, and that's its virtue. Its imperfection or its limitation is the very quality that's strong about the phenomenal worlds. That's why we're in this kindergarten that we're in, because this amount of limitation, which is so severe that we can only see things from one point of view at one time, is necessary, because that's the only way we can develop the waking consciousness and objectivity. Sometimes we have to look at something many, many times in one single, from one outlook again and again, until we finally do see what it really is and what the truth of it is. And so that a lot of the qualities then of Lancelot's limitations are indicated by that. And this also describes the mawkish self-pity of the lower nature, you know, because we are weak. And if we do things for our personal being, we're going to remain weak. The ultimate strength, the subtlety of the spirit, which will ultimately overcome everything, it's sort of, for me, it laughs at me for how weak I am and how much of a whiner and complainer and all such like that. And so it also shows then the covetousness of Guinevere, how the lower self in its self-importance would even try to take unto itself and try to control the divine bride from heaven and say, this is my just due. It can't really take it by storm, but it can in fact see it in a physical sense, but not in a spiritual sense. It always materializes everything and takes away its essential nature, that in the coveting of the personification of the higher nature in the feminine, there is that desire in the egoism of self, from all the self-attention, to say, I'm worthy of this. And the ultimate weakness sometimes in our inverted consciousness in the lower nature, we try to heal ourselves saying, this is what I should have, this is good for me, and there is not the humility that is necessary. So there is a self-indulgence and a personal drawing on that higher self. Lancelot is healed by the Holy Grail, and that healing by the Holy Grail, Holy Grail is the reception of the higher spiritual consciousness, as we're going to see later on, and that is the way the personality is healed. But it takes a tremendous amount of humilification for that to take place, because we have to be ultimately open, and we have to be ultimately obedient to spiritual self, and not self-willed in that lower kind of sense. And that is where the healing comes about. There are a lot of other things that are described when we look at Lancelot in this way, or look at ourselves in this way. And one of them has to do with some of our responsibilities about our existence when we're functioning as Lancelots, as we do most of the time. And that is, Lancelot is the father of Galahad. Galahad, we're going to see in a little bit, though a little bit tonight and more as the story unfolds, Galahad is invincible. And Galahad represents the general power of will of the spirit. Though capable of infinite power, the spirit has to develop it. And it develops it through a process of soul growth. And that soul growth is mostly attained through the impacts in life, and those impacts in life are the consequence of the urgings of the desire of the lower self, what it wants for itself, or the adventure that it wants for itself. And a great deal of the general will of spiritual self is developed in the struggle between self and ego. The battle that we're fighting now, that we are working on to become united with the divine part of our being and to indeed become godly, that struggle, as hard as it may be, is the way the general will is developed. Okay? And in this regard, Lancelot, or the lower nature, provides the necessary resistance to spirit so that as spirit comes into the vehicle, it automatically gets its exercise by overcoming. So this follows in a very clear way when the description of Galahad is that in a strange otherworldly way, Galahad very strongly resembles Lancelot. And that talks about a fact that is very important. The spirit in its becoming can't become anything other than the soul material that it is fed. The spirit has infinite potential, but it can only become the soul material of the experience. Our character is a direct result of our spirit. And in the same way that there's that old maxim that says, the child is the father of the man. In that regard, Lancelot begets Galahad. And what we become in higher spiritual character is directly the result of what we have been in our lower nature. And of course, it gets transmuted all into something wonderful, but that can be done more or less efficiently. That if we overcome and humble the Lancelot part of our being, so that we can have a personality that is more responsive to the higher intent of the spirit, then we can develop a personality that is really a much better kind of a personality. So when we're talking about that, that's about as much as I want to say about Lancelot. We could say a lot more, but I think you get the idea, so that in looking in yourself, or in if you're perusing through, if any of you found the copies of the Holy Grail, after we're done with the notes, I'll lend out my. I have two versions of Mallory. I'll lend them out if you want to read them through. They're really fine, fine reading. They're such curious, different, other kinds of things. But it's you can think about Lancelot in that regard then. All right, now we're going to talk about the three who did accomplish the Grail, but we're going to say very little about them now. We're going to talk more about them next time as we begin working into the story. I just want to say a few general things about the three of them. Now, it's very unusual that the three, only three knights of the Round Table that consummate the highest quest of the Round Table and the greatest knights of all time, very little is said about them. There are books, even way beyond Malory, there are books and other books about Sir Gawain, for example, the solar knight who can fight more and more fiercely as the day goes on until it gets to be noon, and then he gets weaker. He's very much a solar knight, and as the afternoon wears on, he gets weaker and weaker. Of course, by then he's been standing in puddles of blood and sweat and probably urine too, because he just stands. You know, I don't know if you're familiar with the stories, but they have these enormous fights that go for hours and hours and hours and hours. And, you know, it's very bombastic literature, well padded with exaggeration. There's a whole book that is dedicated, for example, to Tristram, or Tristan, as he's sometimes called. The whole book talking about him. There's a lot about Lamoruc and even Palamedes, who caused all kinds of difficulties. But when it comes to the three knights of the Round Table, of the Grail, very, very little is spoken about any of them. The only one that there are many descriptions of at all is Sir Percival, and we'll talk about the whys of that later on. And the strange thing is that these three knights are described not only in minimal ways, but in very fleeting and very shadowy ways. And from a mystical viewpoint, there seem to be two explanations for why this is the case. The three that consummate the Grail represent something that is completely transcendental. They represent something that is beyond concrete thinking. They represent higher spiritual faculties. And to us, from this point of view, being very much stuck in a gross matter that is thick, the things of the spirit, even if we hear of them, we think of them in very materialistic ways, and the subtlety and the power and the glory of spiritual things is lost to us. It's vague and shadowy. The best we can do at sometimes is to have a bit of emotionalism about them. So it isn't then surprising that the things of the spirit would seem very vague and very elusive. A second reason for this is that they do not each represent, you know, unlike Lancelot, who represents a centralized ego, that this is the champion of the Round Table, that everybody has heard of Lancelot, and he is the center of everything. Each of these, with regard to the Grail story, does not represent a person in itself. Each of them represents an attribute of spirit. That is to say, in the threefold nature of the spirit, the divine spirit is represented by Galahad. The life spirit is represented by Percival. And the human spirit is represented by Bors. And these, relative to the whole true spiritual self, these are what surround the eye in the triangle. They are each attributes of the divine, because when we're dealing with transcendental things and that transcendental composite being, which is really not quite an entity, but the word being is probably a better word, when we're looking at something like that, we're looking at something that is infinite. And the consummation of the Holy Grail, as we'll see it, happens when each of them leaves as an individual. I heard a talk just this last weekend on the Holy Grail by Gary Clark, and he was laying down, I don't think we're going to do it in here, but he gave the rules of the quest. If any of you want to hear the tape of that, I'll put a tape together so that you can hear that tape, because it would be supplemental and helpful to what we're saying here. He laid down all the rules of the quest and the kinds of things that happen on the quest. Well, he's a much different kind of talker than I am. He talks to high school kids, and very unruly, tough high school kids up in Wittenberg, Wisconsin, and he has a lot of really redneck types and Native American rebels and things like that in his classes, and he gives his section on the Holy Grail, he gives it with television and street slang. and he does quite a good job of it, but one of the rules of the quest is that everybody must go on the quest of the Holy Grail alone. But the Holy Grail is consummated when or as these three, Sir Bors, Sir Percival, and Sir Galahad, come together, and it we'll see later on when we get into the depth of the story where the Grail itself becomes manifest, that they come into a formation. And this formation has to do with the balance and the, I don't know how you would say it, the dimensional focus of will, wisdom, and activity within our being. When we unfold these different attributes of ourselves, spiritual power and a love that results in a wisdom and an activity that results in a sensitivity, when we develop each of them individually and then bring them into a formation with each other, a balanced kind of formation, then we can reach the spiritual understanding that makes for attaining the unfoldment. So it has to do with the formation of these. Now this is borne out by a dream that happens somewhere along the line, either a dream or a vision. We'll talk a little bit about that later on, because there are all kinds of dreams and visions, and some of which are very fabulous. And in this dream, the three knights that consummate the Holy Grail are pictured as three white bulls. However, the bull that represents Bors has one black spot, and it has one black spot on its forehead. And if we take very simple ostensive symbology, which is somewhat materialistic, it gets us a little bit into the understanding or the interpretation of that dream. The bull, of course, represents positive masculine creativity. And if there is anything that the spirit represents, it represents fecundity and creativity. It's really positive. The passive, negative, receptive matter is associated with the material spheres. White, in this sense, represents both purity and the light of transcendental spirit. So when they're seen as white bulls, they're seen as something that's glowing or radiating light from itself, in that it doesn't have to absorb anything. It can emanate everything. And the black spot, in some ways, represents the one touching point of material manifestation. Now, the way the dream is interpreted in the story of the Grail itself is that Percival and Galahad are virgins. And they are not only virgins, but they are chaste. Percival has a few tests with desire, but ends up being chaste. Galahad is utterly chaste. He has just no thought of sexual possession of another is to him at all. Both Percival and Galahad are aloof. They're above it and distant from it, especially Galahad, very, very aloof. Bors, on the other hand, is sexually active once in his life, and he's sexually active once in his life to conceive. And that once is supposedly that one black spot on the forehead. But there is another way of looking at this with regard to the spirit, and that is that the divine spirit and the life spirit are so-called realms of pure spirit, in that they are unbounded externally or internally. I hesitate to use the word infinite, but the word unbounded is better. Both in externality and internality, there is no binding, there's no limitation. They are utterly alive, and they are utterly filled with truth and power and light and all of those kinds of qualities. The human spirit, on the other hand, is focused in the realm of ideational thought. The realm of thought is divided into two parts, concrete thinking and ideational thinking. But the realm of thought is a quasi-material realm. It's not a completely transcendental realm. So we find in ideational thought, when we form an idea, or when we live within a principle, that principle is universal. It applies universally. So externally, it is unbounded. But an idea has internal bindings and limitations. And each concept, each principle that can be put in a formulometric manner, even though it's universal, it has within itself limitations and it has within itself a structure. Therefore, if we look at the spirit as it focuses into the personality, the human spirit then is in a realm that is somewhat material, and it is bounded and it is limited. So it's quasi-spiritual and quasi-infinite, and at the same time it's quasi-phenomenal. So that is another way of describing and indicating the nature of Bors, Percival, and Galahad. And it ties together perfectly with the interpretation of the dream that's given in the story itself, in the Mallory story, because the human spirit relates to the personage that represents it in the cosmos, is what is called Jehovah or the Holy Ghost, who is the being or the spirit that is in charge of the principle of generative activities. And so Bohr's activity in being generative in the one activity, because when it comes down to it in the cosmic sense, there is only one manifest cosmos. In the same way there's only one manifest spirit, there are maybe many spiritual foci into this realm, but there's only one central cosmos, and it happens only once. And Bors also represents that state that we're all looking for in order to consummate the Holy Grail, which we're going to find has a lot to do with sex, as we talked about last time when we were talking about the general principles of the round table, that there was a lot to do with sex. And the fall of humanity having to do with the abuse of the sexual function, and one of the consequences of that fall is that we have become blinded and darkened in matter, such that we not only sin, but we propagate those sins, and it takes us many, many replications in order to learn something, whereas the ideal should be the Sir Bohr's manifestation, where you only have to do something once to learn your lesson. Once should be enough. One kiss, like from Brunhilde, should be enough I'm mixing myths here. Not a good idea. I did some funny trick on my consciousness for Siegfried. One kiss should be enough to know, and that's all you need. And we should be able to learn all of our lessons from making only one mistake, and we should then be able to propagate them over many times. All right, next time we're going to go more into how each of these knights come to the round table, and when they all come to the round table, and there is then the complete formation of the round table, which has something to do with the completion of the cosmos to the point where the external and the material has gone as far as it can go in its complex ramifications, and then it's time for it to disintegrate, and the whole round table disintegrates in the quest for the Holy Grail. And next time we'll actually even get into the story. And that's about as far as we're going to go. And I hope I'll be able to get much more time to put things together this weekend and next week so that we can get a lot more done. In the meantime, I think what we're trying to do in this myth, more than in any other, we're trying to self-consciously try to find the factors in the people or in characters and actions in the myth in ourselves. And that's something that we have to do. What we have to do is find God in ourselves. I think that the people who practice various forms of analytic psychology and interpret their dreams and do such like that, the principles that they use as more or less as axiomatic, that everything that occurs or everyone that is in a dream is really yourself, I think that is quite good. Even though they don't know that much about the principle of microcosm and macrocosm and the unity that plays throughout the entire cosmos where God is recreated in everything, it's a good way to begin with things, and we can apply that same principle to spiritual things with fuller realization. And that's it.